Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and what we're going to be doing now is to examine some of the historical underpinnings of the coming of the European, not the coming, but the establishment of the European Monetary Union and the Euro. As I speak on January 10th of 1999, the Euro has become a reality and is being forecast as being a relatively strong currency against earlier expectations. It is also being forecast that speculating between the Euro and the dollar could very easily be a good money-making device. And with the U.S. having a huge accounts payable deficit, something that the countries that got looted in the Asian currency speculation, basically their currencies were pegged to the dollar, and they had a balance of payments deficit. Well, we have a balance of payments deficit. We have the dollar, and the conditions surrounding the European Monetary Union might very well, as indicated in a couple of half-hour segments about the euro, the dollar, and currency speculation, it might very well come to pass, and it could prove devastating for the United States. In order to understand what the European Monetary Union is, I think it's important to, among other things, understand the consummately important theories of another Prussian theoretician, namely von Clausewitz, who basically realized that, among other things, that war and politics were interchangeable in an interchangeable equation. Von Clausewitz said, "War is the continuation of politics by other means." It's also that the reverse is true. Politics or economics is the continuation of war by other means. And one of the things that the Prusso-Teutonic mentality, as an author and Pan-German a Pan-German expert Paul Winkler wrote in 1943, that to distinguish between good Germans and the sort of power mongers that have run that country behind the scenes for a long time. By the way, Winkler talks about the Prusso-Teutonic mentality having evolved from the Teutonic Knights, and contrasts that with the vigorous and altogether above board German Merchants League, the Hanseatic League, or the Hansa. The Hansa was defeated in two wars with the Teutonic Knights, and that in many ways shaped, in my opinion, the character of contemporary German power structure. I think it would have been much healthier for the world if the Hansa had prevailed over the Teutonic Knights, but they didn't. And it's the concept of the interchangeability of politics or policy and war is one of the things that has led to German supremacy in Europe, and if one examines the Underground Reich and the deadly Bormann Flight Capital Organization that I speak about so often, I think that the Third Reich gone underground, the Underground Reich, as I have termed it, and the Bormann Organization, which I believe, barring unforeseen circumstances, will prove to be the dominant element in human affairs, one of the things that has enabled them to be so successful is their understanding of the necessity for integrating cycles of military and commercial operations. And what we're going to take a look at in this program is how that happened, specifically how the economies of Europe were gradually subjugated by Germany, and why the European Monetary Union is really, in effect, a German creation. We're going to begin by taking a look at some material which will be by way of review, namely the German corporatist strategy, or the Third Reich's corporatist strategy for world conquest. And to cover this, we're going to take a look at the remarkable book, The Splendid Blonde Beast, subtitled Money, Law, and Genocide in the 20th Century. That's authored by Christopher Simpson. And what we're going to look at now, by the way, that book is published in softcover by Common Courage Press, copyright 1995. And what we're going to look at now is the German corporatist strategy for conquest, which was realized in the Third Reich. And I've included this passage in a number of other broadcasts, including Tides of 20th Century Capital Flow and Part 2 of German Corporate Control of American Publishing. Chris Simpson writes as follows in The Splendid Blonde Beast. In contrast, much of the banking and industrial elite of Germany favored a more traditional, imperial approach to acquiring a new empire in Europe. Among their principal spokesmen were Economics Minister Hjalmar Schacht, Hermann Abs, and a young Reichsbank director, Karl Blessing. Their strategy favored integrating businesses in countries occupied by the Germans into private industrial syndicates coordinated through German-based cartels and through private institutions such as Deutsche Bank. The private companies, in turn, pledged their loyalty to Hitler's government. German military conquest should be used to create conditions through which German corporations could buy up the key enterprises in newly subjugated countries at very favorable prices, this faction contended. But only in rare instances should the state take direct command of industry. Much of the senior leadership of the Deutsche Bank, IG Farben, the Siemens Group of companies, and other German-based cartels maintained that Germany should re-enter the world marketplace rather than attempt to build up the orthodox Nazi dream of a self-sufficient German empire in Central and Eastern Europe. And it was these corporatists who again saw German arms as subjugating the countries that were occupied in order for the German corporations to obtain a favorable advantage in those countries. They then re-entered the world markets. This corporatist approach to conquest was subscribed to by the major industrialists of Germany who were to survive the Third Reich and were to be put right back in power at the end of World War II, largely due to the collaboration of so many of their American counterparts, as I've talked about in numerous archive shows such as Uncle Sam and the Swastika, Uncle Sam and Il Duce, and the first two Radio Free America programs. This group of industrialists was very closely tied in with the Himmlerkreis, or Himmler's Circle of Friends. We read about this in The Splendid Blonde Beast. The notorious Himmlerkreis, the circle of friends of Reichsfuhrer SS Heinrich Himmler, is a good example of the dynamics of Germany's high-level business networks during the decline of the Third Reich. The Nazis and leading German businessmen had jointly created the Himmlerkreis in the early 1930s as an informal communication link between the financial and industrial elite and the SS. Himmler sought the political and economic support of the business elite, and the elite in turn sought influence outside of official channels with the increasingly powerful police leader. Senior business leaders active in the Himmlerkreis included Siemens General Director Rudolf Bingel, Unilever and Continental Oil Director Carl Blessing, steel industrialist Friedrich Flieck, Dresdner Bank's Karl Rascher and Emil Meyer, shipping and oil executive Karl Lindemann, and board members or senior managers from the Deutsche Bank, RKG, IG Farben, Krupp, and a dozen other companies central to the European economy. As the SS grew as an economic power, the SS members of the Himmlerkreis often migrated to new positions on corporate boards where they could secure government contracts and embody corporate loyalty to the regime. SS men and Nazi Party activists who made this transition included Wilhelm Kepler of the Braybag Brown Coal Combine and SS Enterprises, Fritz Kronefuss, Braybag Dresdner Bank, and Ritter von Halt, who joined the Deutsche Bank board. Officially, the Himmlerkreis meetings were not for conducting business, because that would have suggested corruption in National Socialist circles. As a practical matter, however, the encounters served as an informal coordinating point for German industry's negotiations with the SS on policy matters. IG Farben appears to have used Himmlerkreis meetings to seek support for the company's vast forced labor complex at Auschwitz, for example. The companies represented in Himmler's circle became pacesetters in Aryanization, exploitation of concentration camp labor, seizure of foreign companies in the occupied territories, and similar business ventures that depended on SS cooperation. But as the war turned against the Third Reich, a number of business leaders in the Himmlerkreis began to cooperate in clandestine and semi-clandestine contingency planning for the post-war period. Two of the best known of these groups, the Arbeitskreis for, anyway, I'm not going to even try this one, the Working Group for Foreign Economic Questions, and the Kleine Arbeitskreis, or Small Working Group, were nominally sponsored by the Reichsgruppe Industry Association of Major Industrial and Financial Companies. They brought together Blessing, Rascher, Kurt von Schroeder, Lindemann, and others from the Himmlerkreis, with other business people such as Hermann Abs of the Deutsche Bank, Ludwig Erhard, then an economist with the Reichsgruppe Industry and later Konrad Adenauer's most important economic advisor, Ludger Westrick of RKG Aluminum Industry and Non-Ferrous Metals, and Philip Reimtsma of Tobacco and Shipping and Banking, and with the Nazi business specialists as such as Otto Ohlendorf, the former commander of the Einsatzgruppe D murder troops, and Hans Kerrl, SS business specialist. By the way, I would also add the most important of those names is Ludwig Erhard, who was indeed Konrad Adenauer's economics minister. He also succeeded Konrad Adenauer as Chancellor of Germany, and he is a central player here in the Himmlerkreis, the Himmler Circle of Friends, the powerful German industrialists and financiers who supported the SS. By the way, many American subsidiaries in Germany contributed significantly to the Himmlerkreis. But note that Ludwig Erhard is one of the key personages in this group of SS-connected, corporatist, conquest-oriented industrialists and financiers. He was the individual credited with shaping the D-Mark in the post-World War II period, and he eventually became Chancellor of Germany. So please note his presence here. Continuing. A half dozen similar business forums emerged during the last years of the Third Reich. Most of these overlapped in membership, and all of them favored some variation of the corporatist strategy for empire articulated by Hjalmar Schacht, OBS, and others during the showdown over Aryanization in Vienna discussed earlier. That's the passage I excerpted earlier. Now, it's important to understand, and again, this should all be seen against the background of the European Monetary Union, a reality, as I speak, on January 10th of 1999, and in order to understand this as a political entity, one needs to understand what took place in occupied Europe during World War II and what took place afterward. Indeed, the corporatist strategy for conquest was realized, and the subjugation and incorporation of the economies of the occupied nations into the German corporate combines was one of the things that permitted Germany to maintain post-World War II economic control in Europe, and it is why I refer to the European Monetary Union as a German-dominated institution, because the economies of Europe continued to function as, in effect, subsidiaries of the German economy because of the corporatist strategy for empire that was articulated in the passage that I just read from The Splendid Blonde Beast, and because of the activities that I'm now going to cover. And once again, I'm going to access text from the remarkable book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning. That book was published in hardcover by Lyle Stewart Press and copyright 1981. The original Bormann tape excerpted from the Paul Manning book is not available for sale from Spitfire, nor is it cataloged. That is only available to radio stations for airplay only. There are other tapes that I've done that contain information about the Bormann organization. So we're going to turn again to Paul Manning's Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. Paul Manning, by the way, was part of the CBS radio team that covered the war in Europe, along with Edward R. Murrow, whose protege Manning was, and also Walter Cronkite. And he was an excellent journalist and a very brave one. He covered, among other things, the air raids into Germany and occupied Europe during the war. Now, in order to do that, a journalist couldn't just climb on the airplane because they had to carry their own weight. No dead weight could be carried on the plane. So Paul Manning trained as a waste gunner on a B-17 in order to cover the raids and actually was credited with shooting down an ME-109. That is some serious journalism, and Manning carried on his characteristic journalistic excellence and integrity to pursue what I think was probably the story of the 20th century, namely the Bormann Flight Capital Organization. As the war in Europe drew to a close on August 10, 1944, a meeting of key industrialists and financiers with key Nazi Party leaders took place in Strasbourg in 1944. Again, 8-10-44, and the directives were handed down by Martin Bormann, who was the de facto leader of Germany at that point. Martin Bormann was Hitler's key aide, an organizational genius, and arguably the most important figure, in my opinion, of the 20th century. Bormann directed that all of the capital that could be transferred out of occupied Europe before the Nazi collapse should be transferred out of Nazi-occupied Europe. What Bormann did was to set up 750 corporations, transnational corporations, which served as vehicles to transfer this capital into friendly, neutral nations. These 750 corporate fronts worked in combination with many foreign subsidiaries of many of the key German corporations, and they were the vehicle for the, in many ways, for the post-war emergence of Germany as the dominant economic power on the continent. And From the standpoint of institutional analysis, the Bormann organization is discussed in a pair of very important half-hour segments entitled Tides of 20th Century Capital Flow, which will analyze the Bormann organization from an overall macroeconomic and macro-political organization, I should say. We're going to turn now to Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning. Again, hardcover edition, Lyle Stewart, copyright 1981. There's also a softcover edition, I believe a cloth cover edition, by Carroll Publishing, which is apparently still in print. So I strongly recommend that listeners get a hold of this book. In this meeting in Strasbourg in 1944, it was determined that German post-World War II domination of Europe would be altogether possible to maintain. And we should note that one of Martin Bormann's key allies in setting up the flight capital program and the corporate cloaking necessary to mask this were the management of IG Farben, the consummately important German chemical cartel, including Hermann Schmitz and Karl von Schnitzler, two of the key executives with IG Farben. And what we're going to look at now is how IG Farben was able to maintain control of the post-World War II economy, economies of many of the countries they occupied. Turning to Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, we read, IG Farben had been the single largest earner of foreign exchange for Germany during the years of the Third Reich. Its operations in Germany included control of 380 companies with factories, power installations, and mines, as well as vast chemical establishments. It operated in 93 countries, and the sun never set on IG Farben, which had a participation both acknowledged and concealed in over 500 firms outside Germany. They grew as the Third Reich did, and as German armies occupied each country in Europe, they were followed by Farben technicians who built further factories and expanded the IG investment to 7 billion Reichsmarks. The Farben cartel agreements involving trade and the related use of its chemical patents also numbered over 2,000, including such major industrial concerns as Standard Oil of New Jersey, now Exxon, the Aluminum Company of America, E.I. DuPont de Nemours, Ethyl Export Corporation, Imperial Chemical Industries of Great Britain, Dow Chemical Company, Roman Haas, Establishment Kurman in France, and the Mitsui interests of Japan. IG Farben was a formidable ally for Reichsleiter Bormann in his plans for the post-war economic rebirth of Germany. In a telephone conversation with Dr. von Schnitzler, Bormann asked what would the loss of factories in France and the other occupied countries mean to German industry in general and to IG in particular. Dr. von Schnitzler said he believed the technical dependence of these countries on IG would be so great that despite German defeat, IG, in one way or another, could regain its position of control of the European chemical business. Quote, they will need the constant technical help of IG's scientific laboratories, as they do not own appropriate installations within themselves, unquote. He further told Bormann, adding that he and other industrialists such as Hermann Röckling, quote, do not think much of Hitler's recent declaration of a scorched earth policy for Germany. Destruction of our factories will surely inhibit Germany's recovery in the post-war world, he affirmed. Bormann pondered this exchange with von Schnitzler. It was then that he determined to countermand Hitler's order for the ruthless destruction of German industry. He was aware also that the Gauleiters, the regional political supervisors and area commanders of the party, who reported to him as party chief, shared the same view as expressed by Dr. von Schnitzler. And in addition to IG Farben's control of much of occupied Europe through patents, it should be noted that the German pattern of occupation incorporated willing industrial and financial collaborators in such a way as the pattern of collaboration and the economic relationships that dictated that collaboration were perpetuated in the post-World War II period. A very good example of this was how the French economy was subordinated to the German. Turning once again to Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. Society's natural survivors, French version, who had served the Third Reich as an extension of German industry, would continue to do so in the period of post-war trials, just as they had survived the war, occupation, and liberation. These were many of the French elite, the well-born, the propertied, the titled, the experts, industrialists, businessmen, bureaucrats, and bankers. On the other hand, the intellectuals, the writers, the propagandists for the Germans, and the deputies of the Third Republic were among those purged with a heavy hand. The number of Frenchmen who were part of the resistance during World War II was never large, about 2% of the adult population. With the liberation of France, old scores were settled. 124,750 persons were tried, 767 being executed for treason or contract with the enemy in time of war, or contact with the enemy in time of war. Sentenced to prison terms were 38,000, who also endured, quote, loss of national dignity, unquote, disenfranchisement, and ineligibility to hold public office. Even before any arrests and trials could take place, another 4,500 were shot out of hand. Still, economic collaboration in France with the Germans had been so widespread, on all levels of society, that there had to be a realization that an entire nation could not be brought to trial. Only a few years before, there had been many a sincere and well-meaning Frenchman, as in Belgium, England, and throughout Europe, who believed National Socialism to be the wave of the future, indeed, the only hope for curing the many desperate social, political, and economic ills of the time. France, along with other occupied countries, did contribute volunteers for the fight against Russia. Then, there were many other Frenchmen, the majority, who resignedly felt there was no way the Germans could be pushed back across the Rhine. Meanwhile, individuals had to survive. After 1940, France was neatly tucked into the German economic scheme. After 1940, France was neatly tucked into the German economic scheme. Occupied countries would be supply areas for the benefit of the Third Reich. As an example of the cooperating industrialist, there was Marcel Boussac, the richest man in France at the time. This aging cotton textile magnate, now deceased, prospered under German occupation like his peers. He had done well in World War I, and he did well during World War II. In the former, he made his first millions by supplying uniforms and airplane fabric to the French army. Between wars, he expanded, acquiring textile factories by the dozens. When the Germans swept across France in 1940, he promptly turned to them as new customers and began making the cloth for German army uniforms, parachute materials, and linen for fire hose lining, a big-ticket item as British and American bombers set fire to German cities. Other textile manufacturers, particularly those at Calais and Caudry, made the camouflage for such German defense installations as the West Wall and mosquito netting for Rommel's Africa Corps. Boussac and his kind produced a trickle of fabrics for French clothing, but on German orders there was almost no limit to the quantity and quality of goods they turned out for the French fashion industry. German policy was to nurture the haute couture houses of Paris. It brought in foreign exchange, and it was good propaganda to have the world note luxury continuing to flourish as ever in the French capital. In 1943, when the needs of the civilian population were to be met with an annual allowance of 1 kilo of cloth per person, the haute couture received 80 metric tons, enough to fill the regular clothing rations from 80,000 French civilians. Lucien Leland, under German guidance, was the director in charge of policy for the French fashion industry. His collection, and those of 60 other maisons de couture participating in the seasonal fashion shows in Paris for buyers from Germany, the other occupied countries of Europe, and the neutral nations, maintained pre-war Parisian fashion standards. French fashions continued to be sold in markets of the Western Hemisphere throughout the war. One device often used as part of such a marketing scheme was to have fashionable women, quote, expelled, unquote, from France for anti-German and pro-Allied sentiments. The women would then make their way to Lisbon and sail for New York or Buenos Aires on a neutral steamer with their trunks containing the latest creations of Leland and his group of national and corporate assets to safe havens throughout the neutral nations of the rest of the world. By the way, Leland is capital L-E, capital L-O-N-G. Continuing. Martin Bormann knew in his heart that the war in Europe was over when Normandy was lost. Oh, excuse me, that's a passage that I'd read earlier. Resuming again with the last sentence. The women would then make their way to Lisbon and sail for New York or Buenos Aires on a neutral steamer with their trunks containing the latest creations of Leland and his group of collaborating maisons de couture. Orders were taken, paid for, and filled. This was collaboration, but few in this industry were to go on trial, any more than were the industrialists who owned the textile companies, chemical plants, and heavy industry. However, the rayon industry was more than a collaboration between French and German interests. The Gilles Carnot organization of the French rayon interests had close pre-war relationships in price controls and markets to the German Kunsteide and the Zellweger Ring, and this laid the foundation for fuller collaboration after the collapse of France. By December 1940, most of the rayon-producing facilities in France were united under a new holding company, France Rayon, to which the German Ring Group contributed 33% of the capital in the form of patent rights and technical advice. The capital of those French companies that became subsidiaries of France Rayon totaled over 800 million francs. Three-quarters of this sum were represented by National Viscose and Givet Isieux, in which the Gillet and related families such as Ballet, Bizot, and Motta were the largest shareholders. The large French chemical interests of Kuhlmann also had their agreements with IG Farben and industry long before the war. Then, when France fell, this relationship ripened, expanding into full German majority control and stock ownership. The IG board of directors formed a new French holding company, capitalized at 800 million francs, and named it Francolor. It held the stock of Kuhlmann and other French dye and chemical interests. 51% of Francolor's stock was acquired by IG Farben Industry, without whose basic patents no chemical company in Europe could operate. And by the way, this control through patents was envisioned by the IG leadership in consultation with Martin Bormann in a passage I read earlier. Continuing with the text. The Germans were also diligent in acquiring stock control in other prime industries, and when their troops were forced from France in 1944, their economic imprint would remain. This is one of the reasons I'm going into this. I can appreciate that there may be people who are saying, oh, there goes Dave again, talking about the Bormann organization, all this stuff back in World War II. Well, you know, we're not interested in that. We want to know what's going on today. Well, what's going on today is the euro, and it's ironic that many people in the audience are probably going to have their lives devastated by the economic conditions produced by the euro, which is the realization of a plan for German world conquest that was formulated in the 1840s and has been consummated in a series of wars and economic maneuvering in the 20th century. We're going to continue with our analysis of the German control of post-World War II France and Europe, something that is altogether significant in terms of understanding of the European Monetary Union. However, we're going to do that in our next half-hour segment. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.